Hey everybody, I want to give you a gift before we dive in. If you're at the beginning of your content marketing journey, or if you've been doing it a while, but it's not working as well as you want and you feel like something is missing, I want to give you a roadmap to help you get more ROI out of your content. This is my blog remix method, and it's a shortcut to go from one blog to dozens of pieces of content in less than 60 minutes. Even if you have webinars, podcasts, and video content, you can take the transcripts and follow the guidelines in the exact same way. It's a great resource. It's free. You should have it. If you haven't downloaded it already, grab it right now at justinsimon.co/remix. If you're listening to the podcast feed, you can click the link right below and download it. Get it, read it, apply it. It takes you step by step to get more value out of your blog content and get it in front of your audience. So grab the guide, get a blog, and get it running. That's my blog remix method, and it's free at justinsimon.co/remix. Hey everybody, before we get started, I want to thank my friends at Hatch for producing this episode. You can get unlimited podcast editing and strategy for one flat rate by visiting hatch.fm. All right, let's get in the show. Welcome to Distribution First, the show where we flip content marketing on its head and focus on what happens after you hit publish. Each week, I share playbooks, motivations, stories, and strategies to help you repurpose and distribute your content because you deserve to get the most out of everything you create. Hey everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Distribution First. So excited to have Ryan with me today, and we're going to be chatting a little bit of a divergent path, but it's all going to tie back in to what we all love and talk about here, which is distribution, repurposing content, actually really doing content marketing the smart way, more efficient way. And so really today, what we're going to talk about is how do we as content marketers or marketers in general, how can we focus on what we need to work on versus what we think we should be working on versus what we're told we should be working on versus there's no time to work on the things that I need to work on because I'm in 18 meetings a day. So we're going to talk about all of those things today. Super excited to have Ryan on the show. Ryan, welcome, man.
Hey, Justin. How you doing? Glad to finally be here.
Absolutely. So it was funny. It was kind of serendipitous. As we were talking about this topic and what we were going to talk about, I came across this quote from Tim Ferriss that I think is a great starting point for this whole conversation, which is doing something unimportant well does not make it important. Doing something unimportant well does not make it important. And I think that's a huge sort of launching point for how we do things. I think sometimes as marketers, especially, it's easy to get sucked into the tactics. It's easy to get sucked into the work and make everything important. And really, at the end of the day, the unimportant things that we think we're doing well, it doesn't actually make them important at all.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So I guess, talk me through a little bit in your roles as you've sort of, you come from Gorgeous, you've worked at other companies, now you're working for yourself as well. So talk to me about either your struggles or maybe some of those experiences that you've had in terms of prioritizing the correct things or even just coming up with what the heck is the most important thing that I should be working on.
Oh my God. Yeah. I mean, like, it is to this day a constant struggle. Like, when I texted you before this and I like dropped this topic because it's been on my mind from therapy this morning, and I am not coming at this. I may be on a podcast right now, but I am not coming at this from any place of expertise. I'm coming at this from a place of being very interested in it because of how bad I am at it, right? And how I want to get better. I think when you start consulting, everything is a trade-off. You're in-house, it's all a trade-off. You spend time doing one thing versus another or working extra hours, that's a trade-off on things you could be spending time with a partner or family or friends. But when you get to set your own 40 hours a week, and in our cases, like, is it even 40 hours a week? The trade-offs become so apparent and like so present in your day-to-day thinking. And so I've always known I need to prioritize better and ship faster and all these things we all say we want to do. But when I don't have to be on until 6 and I could be at the park right now and I'm not because I'm doing a thing that I don't need to do, you really feel it in a new way. Because, you know, there's like Parkinson's law, like the work expands to fill the time. And so when you have 8 hours a day at work, you're like, well, I got to be here till six. You're not really incentivized to like speed it up, especially since a lot of people who are really efficient get rewarded by like taking on someone else's work that they didn't finish. So, you know, it is kind of like an interesting shift. And even Erica Schneider posted yesterday about this idea of over-strategizing and taking too long. It's never done, like just ship it. And I posted a little bit about what I've been working on, which is understanding that perfectionism, I think for everyone in all cases, is like at its core an anxiety response, right? Because wanting to do good work, wanting to get better results, those are absolutely things that can drive that anxiety response, but they're not what's driving the perfectionism. Because if you wanted to do good work and get results, you would ship the thing and you would let it be good work that gets results. And so I think for me, the first unlock happened when I was at Gorgeous, realizing that if I actually want to make something not perfect, because that's impossible, but close as possible, you have to ship it as part of that before it's done, actually, which is the hard part. Because if you want to make the best thing possible, necessarily you have to start getting those ideas out, start battle testing them, getting feedback from the market, right? We all, as content people, have a story of the blog post or the LinkedIn post that we overthought and overdid, but then we were like, it's worth it because it's going to be a banger. And then it is not a banger, because at the end of the day, you just don't know until it goes out. And so I'm really trying to take more of this iterative approach. Oh yeah. And so like that feedback loop was the first unlock. I'm not doing this efficiently. Like I think I'm being efficient by only doing it once, but that's actually not even possible. The second unlock, the more important unlock that actually has started to do it for me, is recognizing this stress response isn't coming from this project will be bad and there will be consequences, because no one bad project, for the most part, sinks any of us, right? It's the self-worth and sense of self that we have tied up in our work and our ability to be productive. That's what takes the hit, or what we imagine will take the hit from shipping bad work, right? Erica's post was most human response gets a cookie. And the end of my comment was like, never ever received a cookie for the ideas that are idealized in my head that no one knows about. Gotten a lot of cookies though for shit that I shipped that I wasn't happy with and thought it wasn't ready. And then it worked really well. So I think there's a lesson in that, mostly for me. I'm speaking to myself and trying to like, this newsflash is for me almost entirely.
1000%. This is the thing too. It's like, if you're listening to this show, you're probably on the higher end of achiever than somebody who's not, right? So I think if you're washing the dishes or walking your dog and you're listening to Distribution First, you're probably a little bit on the high achieving end. So I'm sure lots of people relate to that. I'm on the high achieving end. And I think we all, anybody who bends that way holds themselves to a much higher standard than anybody else would. And sometimes it's to the detriment, and you touched on it with the ideal standard. And so when you measure yourself against an ideal, you're never going to get there. I've heard it described as the horizon line, right? If your ideal is I'm going to hit that line, and yet every bit of progress you make, that line never gets closer, and that's your measuring point, you're going to be miserable. And so you feel like you're doing so many things, and yet there's no way that you can even get there because you've set your measurement point at a place that is completely and utterly unrealistic.
Absolutely.
So what I've sort of found, and what I've started to do, that has completely changed how I measure myself, how I'm viewing success. It's allowed me to ship things faster. And this has really only started really this quarter, is measuring backward. So measuring backward on how much further am I at the end of Q1 compared to the beginning of Q1? How much further am I in March compared to February? What learnings have, like having learning be a goal? Learning by shipping, by sending that email series that I did not want to send because it was salesy. Oh, I learned I could sell a workshop and I could write it. I learned that. I could do that. That's how you build confidence and you're able to do more things. But yeah, when you have that ideal set of this is what a good blog, even on a tactical, like something you want to create, this is what a blog post is, this is what this is, and we've all been through rounds of edits and 100 things, and it's never the perfect thing. One of my buddies who does video is like, a video is never done. It's never done because you can always edit it, you can change this, you can fix it. And so you just got to ship.
Yeah. And you know, something that's been really helping me with all of this mindset outside of just therapy is I've been reading Rick Rubin's book. I've been listening to a lot of his podcasts on this circuit he's doing. And I've had folks that I really admire where I'll listen to them on a couple different shows. And even some of the ones that I'm like a big fan, they've got their talk track that they've worked on with, they're selling their thing. And Rick Rubin's book comes from such an authentic place in him that the host can kind of take it in whatever direction that they want. And because what he's selling is his philosophy, he doesn't have to bring it back. It just like, it applies. So like I listened to him do like an On Being episode with Krista Tippett, and that shows very much about a holistic and well-lived life. And like, what does that mean? And how does creativity fit into that? And how can we release some of these expectations on ourselves to be happier and more at peace? And then I went and listened to him on like the Happiness Project, I think it's called. Dude took a completely different avenue. And another thing I don't love about podcasts is sometimes it feels like the guest, especially with someone like Rick Rubin, who's like a legend, is unwilling to like challenge them because what am I going to say to Rick Rubin? You know what I mean? But he really embraced that and was also very quick to be like, I disagree with the way you just took that thing that I said, but it wasn't you're wrong. It's we have different perspectives. And I think that's been something that in a lot of areas of my life, but especially in marketing, where it's business and you really want to get it right, kind of letting go of the fact that there is no absolute truth anywhere, right? In marketing especially, but in life, you know what I mean? At least not objective, right? Because for everything you think is an objective truth, there's someone else who is not accepting of that. And so in my content efforts, I'm leaning more into wanting personal POVs to drive the work that I do. Even if you do a study, to have five people with different perspectives on it, give full commentary to like give the context from their perspective and not just getting quotes from 10 people and finding the mean, really showcasing that there are different approaches to this. I think best practices are not useless, but I do think we rely far too much on them. I'll speak for myself. In the past, I have relied way too much on best practices because like everyone, I want to achieve and accomplish the results that I'm set in my OKRs. And the best practice is like a proven way, proven framework, playbook to get there. What I'm realizing looking back and also just looking around, talking to a lot of consultants, working at a lot of different companies, talking to a lot of in-house folks, it's not even that best practices are not the full picture and there's nuance beyond it. I'm like kind of not huge on them at all right now because to me, best practices are designed to reduce to that mean, to reduce the surface area for failure. And in business and in life to a degree, we are really incentivized to not fail, right? You can have an absolute banger quarter and take that risk. And people will be like, yeah, pat you on the back, but then you're only as good as your next quarter's numbers. If you have a dismal quarter, you're not going to see your next quarter's numbers. You won't be there to tell that story a lot of times. I'm not blaming anyone. Like, I totally understand why we're incentivized to not take risks. It's like the idea of no one ever got fired for hiring Deloitte because people would rather hire the firm that can be the scapegoat that is respected and lose than take the risk to win big, but then have to eat it with the risky option if it doesn't go well, right? And I think I just said a lot, so I'll let you respond to that. But that's kind of where I'm at is not only are we not incentivizing great work, I think we're like actively making it impossible when everything has to follow this best practice. And I've just seen too many founders point at these companies that are unicorns who took big risks that paid off and did things that no one else was doing and say, be like them. But they think they're going to get there by trying a new outbound sequence.
Right.
It's no risk, no reward, you know?
Right. Well, and it's never the tactics that get them there.
Right.
Microsoft could do the exact same tactics as Apple and fail miserably because Apple, at least at the time with Steve Jobs, when everything was really exploding, was willing to take risks And I think to Steve Jobs' credit, if you pulled the board when he was going after the sort of outcast as the target market, I bet there's a whole slew of folks who said that was the dumbest idea. It's too small. What they missed that Steve Jobs understood was that everybody has a little bit of that in them.
Mm-hmm. Because he wasn't going on a dashboard. He was right. Tapping into something that he felt deeply as a human being and saw in others and in himself. And I think when you look at why Steve Jobs was successful, a big part of it was he had a very strong POV, mm-hmm. that he was unafraid. He would rather go down doing it his way than doing it the safe way. And obviously, he had great instincts over time. And we see that in the products that launched under his tenure. But I don't know. I think there are things that Steve Jobs launched that if another company did the exact same launch, exact same way, it wouldn't have worked. I think people like the audacity of it to a degree. It feels authentic and it feels bold. And the fact that they know Steve Jobs doesn't care is, I think, kind of the point. And he had a lot of good checks in the right areas. So I think that's the other side of this, because then you have the founders who think that they walk on water and don't ever want to listen to their team. And that's also wrong, because A, you're not Steve Jobs. And even Steve Jobs was wrong plenty of times. You look at stuff that he wrote or that was written about him. And there's a quote from, I think Andy Grove said it, who was the CEO of Intel, wrote High Output Management, one of my favorite management books. But I think it's in Radical Candor, actually, Kim Scott's book. And she's talking about basically having lunch with Andy Grove. And she was like, yeah, like, it's crazy, Apple's on such a tear. And he goes, yeah, well, you know, Steve and the guys at Apple, they always get it right. And he was like, no one always is right. And he said, I didn't say he was always right. I said he always gets it right. Mm-hmm. And if you actually look at her examination of the culture at Apple during the time when these big innovations were happening, first of all, it seems pretty toxic. So there was definitely a better way to do it.
I was going
to
say, it's not all roses, but
it's definitely not. And I'm not saying that you need to be an ass like Steve Jobs was to get this done. But what I do think he did really well is, if you didn't challenge him and he realized that you had the answer and you were too scared to say it, he held you accountable for that. Like, it was as bad to be quiet. It's actually worse probably to him than to be wrong. And so that's kind of the point Andy, I think, was making in that passage, which I probably badly paraphrased. But the idea is, you have to both be bold, but you also have to like empower the people around you to be bold, to tell you when you're off track. Because the downside of a singular POV is that there's no feedback loop in your head.
I can tell you from 12 years of working in-house, now working with several companies and talking with several companies, having a POV is a very rare place to be for a company. And having a founder who owns the POV and understands the market and understands the why behind the product, it's rare. It is rare to have, you know, and then have that spread through the entire company.
Totally.
I think there's a reason why at the heart, if you're looking at the heart and the core reasons why those things struggle, is like, okay, marketing department, go create some messaging. This is who we are as a company. Marketing department struggles to come up with anything that resonates with the founder or the CEO, or they come up with something, but it doesn't truly feel authentic because it's not. And so I think I can say, even for my small level of success that I've been able to have with Distribution First, it all comes back to having that core point of view over time that I actually believe and care about. And it's not to say Distribution First is the only way you can do content marketing. I've never said Distribution First is the only way you can do content marketing. I've said it's a differentiated, potentially better way if you want to get the same output with less inputs and get more bang out of your buck, all that type of stuff. But you can run a successful content marketing program with volume and manage a volume. That's not how I would do it anymore, but you can do that. Totally. And so I think that that's the core of it too, is being able to have a really strong point of view that you care about and you believe in, and a story that you believe in, way easier as a solo person to figure those things out than if you're working at a company. But if you're looking to move jobs, if you're looking to, how do I advance in my career? What am I looking for? Those would be some of the main things I would be looking for moving forward, because that's how companies are going to win when I mean, I saw somebody the other day kind of just chatting, and it's like they're waiting for the Costco version of Salesforce to come out, like Kirkland Salesforce, where it's like a tenth the cost with all the feature. Like, mm-hmm. It's a kind of a funny joke, but that could happen. There's no reason why that couldn't happen. And so unless you are sort of building your business in that way, that's going to be hard to compete on. But
yeah,
just to keep things moving, talking really about the productivity side and to move that back, I'm curious on your end, one of the things I think people struggle with when it comes to prioritization is even going back to the important versus unimportant, urgent mm-hmm. versus, you know, like the classic quadrant, if anybody's familiar with the Eisenhower quadrant. And if not, make sure to look that up because it's a helpful exercise. But for me, I always love the analogy of the big rocks, pebbles, and sand. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with that, Ryan?
Okay, so I am. And it was a huge thing at Gorgeous to the point where our all hands meetings were literally big rocks on our calendar was the name. But I made it through 2 years at Gorgeous and no one explained to me what the hell big rocks are. So Justin, I think you should just share really quick what the concept is. Because once I actually learned what it meant, now it's all clicking. Why didn't someone just tell me that? I thought it was they're big boulders. So you have to like push them forward slowly, but they're important.
Got you. Yeah. Big rocks are like life's a jar. Your work is a jar. You've got this jar of stuff. And then big rocks being your most important things. These are the things we have to get done. Pebbles being like, this stuff is okay. It's not necessary. Sand being like the worthless junk that we kind of need to do to keep the lights on, but is really unimportant in the macro. And so if you think about this from like a content perspective, because you can break this down in a business, you can break this down for a content. So let's look at it from a content perspective. A lot of people that I coach and consult with, they have big rocks. And part of the problem is they have so many big rocks, you could never fit them all in the jar to begin with. Mm-hmm. So that's one problem. You might have so many big, small, little rocks and your jar container is only so big. The volume does not
match. Or they have the right number of big rocks, but in their Notion doc, they have a lot of pebbles sized bigger than they actually are in real life, right?
Well,
because if you don't deprioritize, then there are no big rocks. I'll let you continue, but I think that's like an important distinction.
Yeah. And so the idea being like, you've got these unimportant tasks, kind of important tasks and really important tasks. And what ends up happening for most people, myself included, unless I'm being focused on this, is that your jar fills up with sand. And sand being meetings, emails, scrolling LinkedIn, mindlessly flipping through the 18 tabs that are on your browser because they're there and they must be important. And now I got to check this and I got to check that. I bet if you audited your time, because I did this at the beginning of the year, if you audited your time, most of your time would be spent on sand. So your jar is like 3/4 of the full of sand. And then after that, it might be some pebbles, which are maybe sending emails, not replying, but you've got some important stuff you got to reply to, send those things. Writing LinkedIn posts, creating maybe some smaller email campaigns, that type of stuff. Small things, but not movers. And then your jar fills up with that. And then at the end of the day, you have no time for the big rock moving things, the content initiatives you want to move forward, the strategic thinking you need to have done, the planning you need to do, all the things you actually have to get done. And so for me, it's been shifting priorities and actually starting. What I've been doing is laying understanding what my big rocks even are for a quarter. And so if you have, and this really ties into like my whole methodology around cornerstone content, core content, and cut content, which is like, if you don't get your big rock right, the stuff coming off of it at the bottom will not matter, or you're not going to have time for it or any of those things. So if you don't have time to record the podcast, to write the blog post, to write the newsletter, all the rest of the stuff starts to fall apart. And then you lose consistency. You don't have room for that. So what I've done is I've actually said, like, these are my big rocks every single week from a content perspective. Just as an example, let's say it's podcast, it's newsletter. Like if I were to talk about, those are the big rocks. And then those get scheduled out on the calendar. So podcast is going out here, newsletter is going out here. And then I can work back the schedule on when I want to create those pieces of content. Pebbles also get scheduled. I've got to write the promo email that goes out. I've got to send the promo email that goes out. I've got to be able to write those things. I got to be able to write the social content, make sure the clips are organized. Those things get scheduled out. And then sand, that's just kind of like time blocking that to a different part of the day where I'm not feeling like I have to come into the day, check all my email, get email done. Cause that's the problem, is when you start your day with sand, you never get to your big rocks.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I agree with everything you said. I think you really explained the concept well. And so I have a few kind of builds on the concept that I'm realizing for me. I don't know if I'm comfortable saying that these are like universal, but I will speak on what I have noticed personally, which is the big rocks. So part of the thing that I had to understand was the big rocks alone are enough, or maybe not everything you want it to be, but a jar filled to the top with pebbles and sand is not nearly as powerful as just the four big rocks in the jar with all that empty space, because you did the things that mattered, right?
Big things, important things that you've already said, these are big things and important things.
Yeah. And I think like when SaaS companies do this really badly in a lot of cases, but I can also say I do this not great, is like you have the big rocks, right? Let's say you have the perfect big rocks, you're prioritizing them. But if you come at it from the perspective of like the big rock is first and the pebbles are second, but it all needs to get done, then you're not actually really, the way it should be is how long does the big rock need? And then fill the remaining time with pebbles. Because if the whole to-do list has to get done, yeah, you're putting the order in the right order, but you're not prioritizing. You're just, I mean, it's prioritizing in a way, but it's like only on a daily level. You know what I mean? Like what gets done first in the day. And so I'm really trying to internalize this concept I heard of, you know, we're all juggling these balls, right? You're going to drop them. It's not if, it's when. It just is, right? So instead of trying to keep all these balls up in the air, which is only going to lead to you losing controls over which ones drop and when, because they are going to drop. Again, this is an inevitability, unless you are just like Tim Ferriss and you have 8 hours of work on your schedule for the week. Or on the flip side of this, you could basically take control, drop the ones that are rubber. So it's this idea of like rubber versus glass balls, right?
Okay.
And so the rubber balls, they don't feel good to drop. And that's why I like this analogy, because you're still dropping them. It still feels bad, but you can pick them up and dust them off and get them back in the air and it's fine. But you drop a glass ball once and it's done, right? So that intro that you offered proactively to make for a friend that they've already forgotten about the second they logged off your call, that's looming over your head, that's a rubber ball.
Oh yeah, that's sand. That's sand, yeah.
I would say it's a rubber ball, because I would say it's a pebble, because I think it's really important to keep your word and to be connecting people. Yeah. Maybe it's a small pebble. But my point is like, you can make that intro in 3 weeks. Well, they'd be stoked, right? Because they forgot. And now you're coming out of nowhere and making this introduction. They're stoked. They don't care about the timing. But if you start missing distribution first meetings with guests and start to develop a reputation that you don't show up, like that's a glass ball. And the way this is showing up for me personally as a consultant right now is everything that's internal to me is all rubber balls, because only I will be upset. And I'm trying to like recognize the glass nature of the balls that involve work and relationships with other people, because you only have so many shots at the way someone perceives you, and trust is really easily broken, right? And so why am I spending 3 hours reorganizing my Notion and 10 minutes prepping for a call with someone I care about? That doesn't balance for me. So I think understanding that to get all the big rocks in the jar, all the pebbles won't fit, was really important for me, because you just have to be okay with the fact that it's all not going to happen. And every company, every company I've talked to, I won't even name names, because I don't want to get their content marketers in trouble. But talking to people that are at these big unicorn companies that all of our CEOs want to be like, it's a mess there too. They are just as burned out, if not more. And what those companies do well is that they are prioritizing the right fires so that they continue to grow in spite of the chaos versus like fighting the wrong fires and putting all the energy and not growing. But like, it's still chaos. Like the to-do list never ends. There's always more that you could do. And so I think that's like one of my big ads of the three. Another is like the sand. And even honestly, some of the pebbles maybe are like a performance for the other people at your job. I read an incredible newsletter article a couple weeks ago that I will give to you to put in the show notes. And basically the title of the newsletter is called LARPing Your Job. Justin, do you know what LARPing is?
I've heard of it, but yeah, explain.
It's an acronym that stands for live action role playing.
Ah.
So like if you were ever in college, you're like on the quad and people are fighting with foam swords and stuff.
Got
it's like that,
you.
Right?
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
And so she basically made the case that the digital nature of work now and the Slack, every conversation you have at work now has like a record in Slack, which makes you want to show up and be there more. And you're not in the office to show face and have a personality. So you feel even more driven to be around. Like I can speak for myself. I absolutely at Gorgeous, we had a pretty active Slack culture and we were really good compared to most companies about response times. Like it was actually like you could wait 24 hours and you would not get in trouble to get back to someone. Now they might not be happy, but like that was a rule that was written in Notion, right? That being said, there were constantly conversations happening and I wanted to be there and be a part of them and be seen being a part of them. I don't even think I was doing it on purpose at the time, but looking back, like it's definitely something that was intentional, right? And so her argument is how much energy and time are we wasting doing the performance? That's even like one level deeper than doing the wrong work. That's not doing any work. You're like tap dancing on stage for people you don't even know. And so I think that that's something to keep in mind. But the flip side of that one though is that a lot of times in the past, I at least, and I know many others who have done this too, want to like designate the work around the work, the getting buy-in, the managing up, all the meetings as like just sand. Like, why are you wasting my time? I could be doing it. And in some cases, you may be right, but unfortunately, the work around the work is the work. Getting things sold in is the work. You can have the best campaign in the world, and if it never goes out, you didn't have the best campaign in the world. You had a really cool idea that you couldn't get done. You know what I mean? Benjamin Elias has a newsletter called Diamond Pencils that genuinely I reach for before Harvard Business Review on things like this. And again, because it's a very personal POV from Benjamin, who I trust, not some random byline who happens to have an MBA. Like, cool. Not to talk down about HBR, great publication, but in terms of trust for me, they may have more credibility, but I trust Benjamin more.
Oh, sure.
That's something I'm trying to really hone in on and even maybe make a consulting offer around is like content marketers are like everyone else. No one wants to spend time getting the work done. Everyone wants to do the work that they feel like is actually going to drive the results. But I think a lot of content marketers are creative at heart and that's why they got into it. And they still have this kind of like creatives versus suits dichotomy and selling in the work and the corporate jockeying and the politics that's just actually work culture is the work, unfortunately. And so I think we all, and I can speak for myself 100%, that was something I could have done better at Gorgeous. And I could have probably gotten more done if I had been better at explaining the why. And then the last thing I will say is we did retros every quarter at Gorgeous. I can't speak for every team at Gorgeous, but I know that the marketing teams, a lot of times, it ends up just being a time capsule showing you that you didn't fix things over time and that they just keep happening again and again. The reflection is great, but if you don't do anything about it, then what's the point of doing it? And so something, again, it comes back to the shipping and the experiments and the volume. And that's where volume is a good play, even if you're not trying to go for content volume. You know, Alex Burkett, who runs On Mission Digital with his partners, and he's really brilliant. He comes from a background in marketing experimentation at CXL. And I've been asking him a lot of questions about it recently. And he'll basically tell you, with nuance, there's obviously ways to do better experiments. But generally, the way to do better experiments is to do more of them, so you can see what works and what doesn't, because you don't know what you don't know until you discover it, right? And so I do think that we're all trying to find this like 80-20 Pareto perfect balance, but that's the whole thing. You don't know it going in. Assuming it because of a best practice is also not knowing it going in. Doing it for a quarter, getting the feedback that your customers love it and that it presents outsized like pipeline, and then doing it and doubling down the next quarter, that's the Pareto principle. Putting all your eggs in one basket because it seems like the best or safest option, like categorically not the Pareto principle, actually just really not diversifying your portfolio of strategies.
Yeah. The hard thing with that prioritization, because it's hilarious. Like I've been in so many planning meetings where I think this joke might even been made at some point in the last decade in a meeting I've been in, because we used to talk about the big rocks too. And it's like, there's too many big rocks. We have not enough jar and too many rocks. And so I think the hardest thing to do is to ruthlessly eliminate the things that aren't going to move the needle. You know, I can speak from experience at building up this business. There are a million things that I can do. a million of them. I could go all in on YouTube, just in content. I could go all in on YouTube. I could stick with the podcast. I could expand out to a different channel. I could try shorts. I could try this. I could do that. Mm-hmm. I could offer a million different types of services. I could test this out, and I'm just testing this out over here, right? But everything I do is taking away from something else that I'm not going to do over here. And so, like, for me, I really start, again, it's funny you brought this up because it's like so top of mind for me because I started the year this way, is like, what are the three goals? What are the three things in Q1 that I'm going to get done? And mm-hmm. I have looked at those goals almost every single day for the entire quarter. And the funny thing about that is I was looking at it yesterday. I've almost completed all of them. Mm-hmm. There's little steps in a couple of them that I haven't finished, but I would say 80% of the goals that I set out to do in Q1 have already been hit.
Hell yeah.
So now I'm trying to look and I'm trying to figure out, okay, and I will say this too, like, they weren't necessarily revenue goals or things like that. They were like tangible, actionable things that I could measure against. And it was way more helpful for me to do that versus just like a random number of something that I was trying to hit. And so for me, it's been really cool to do that. And so I'm planning on doing the exact same thing in Q2, and I'm going to start planning those things out. What are those goals I want to hit? And then the key that we didn't talk about is with those big rocks is chunking up the things into smaller milestones. So you can keep winning and feel like you're making progress against that bigger goal. So for example, one of the things I wanted to do in Q1 that I did in January was do a paid training. And so with that paid training, I had a whole slew of, and it was like, I've never done this before. It's kind of overwhelming, like all the things I might need to do. So chunk it out. I need to create an email series. I need to create the deck. I need to create the topic. I need to, you know, send it out. I need to do the post show send to the group and give them the replay. I need to, you know, house it up on here so that somebody can get it after the fact. And by having those things chunked out, it made it so much more approachable and so much more easy to be like, oh, okay, this week I'm going to work on this chunk of this big rock.
Yeah.
And from there, it, you know, it allows you to build and make progress. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, like, retrospective feels like such a scary word. And there is, it's called the retrospective prime directive, I think. I found it in someone's blog. I'll try to find it so we can source it. But I put it at the top of every one of my retros with my team because it's basically like we are all going to agree going into this that we're going to look back critically, but that everyone was doing their best with what they had at the time. You have to be honest. And if you feel like you're going to hurt someone's feelings, you can't be honest. And so I think that's important. But in terms of like milestones, I think you're totally right. And something I'm trying to do for myself is, you know, startup and shutdown, just like 5 minutes at the beginning and end of the day every day. Mm-hmm. And then like a weekly review. Maybe a monthly review, but definitely a quarterly review. And again, like retrospective puts all this weight on it. It's a check-in with yourself. You're looking back and you're saying like, I want to be intentional and aware of what happened, because it's so easy to just barrel into the next quarter and let all of that kind of straight over your head. And I think that you need to do both, because what I found at Gorgeous is like you're at the end of the quarter, you're grabbing all of these things that you can't even remember doing because it was 2 months ago and you feel like it's been a year, and you're trying to like find the Slack conversation to describe what happened. Yes, there's value in doing the long-term look back over 3 months with distance, but A, if you're not doing the smaller check-ins over time, you're coming at that perspective like almost too blind looking back. Like you've actually let it fully leave your field of vision and brain. But also, you are not getting that real-time view from when it happened to look at also, because you can look back in 3 months and get a worse perspective on something that happened. Like, distance is not always a good thing. You know what I mean? It's good when you have all of the checkpoints to then compare against, and then you can kind of like go back and forth. But generally, you don't want to just look back every 3 months. And so I think at the end of the day, this is something everyone struggles with. I do think that there is like a certain performance in new content, new bylines, all of these things that make it harder to refresh, repurpose, distribute, do all the things with the content that is already ranking, that is already converting, that you know is the Pareto principle because it's one of your like content power law whales. And at the end of the day, it's like the two breakdowns, I think, is if you are having trouble prioritizing and you're doing too much, to me, the two places where it breaks down is either you don't understand the program or the data or the feedback loops well enough to know what should be prioritized, or you do and your boss doesn't, and your shortcoming is more on the side of you can't sell it in. You can't convince them that what you know to be true is true, right? And that's not to put everything on the direct report or the content person, but you can only control that side. So that's something I'm trying to be more conscious of, even in consulting. Like, in what way could I have done this better? And it's usually one of those two ways. It's like, either I didn't know the story well enough, or I didn't sell it well enough.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that's kind of what it comes down to.
And at the end of the day, you have to have that story, whether you're going to be, or that system, or what, you know, whatever you're going to be executing on to know those priorities. You have to know what you're going after. And then you have to know, how the heck do I pitch this up and make sure that that's something that we can actually execute on and tell that story and all that stuff. So yeah, Ryan, we will have to have you back at some point to chat about maybe some more content specific things. But this was a super fun conversation on mentality, on mindset shift, on trying to weigh out what the heck to do. And it was a blast, man. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
All right, I hope you enjoyed this episode of Distribution First, and thank you for listening all the way through. I appreciate you so, so much. And I hope you're able to apply what you learned in this episode one way or another into your content strategy as well. Speaking of strategy, we have a lot of things going on this year that are going to help you build your brand, 10x your content, and transform the way you do content marketing. Make sure to subscribe to the show and sign up for my newsletter at justinsimon.co so you don't miss a thing. I look forward to serving you in the next episode as well. And until then, take care, and I'll see you next time.